Hi there, everybody. Welcome to another episode of the Cloud-Based Mayhem. Just got back from a short trip out to San Bernardino in California to do some training with Ben Abruzzo and Dave Harrington. Dave and I are supporting Ben in the upcoming XPeer this June, flipping the roles here a little bit with Ben after all the many, many years of training and support he has given me in the Red Bull XAlps. That was a lot of fun. And the other purpose of the trip was to go out there and do some podcasts. And the first one is released to you here today with John Heine. Heine has been flying since 1978. He is still passionate about it. He's got 40 hang gliders in his garage. We had an exceptionally fun talk out at his shop. He's a machinist, a diesel rabbit aficionado. He is an incredible photographer. He builds all kinds of crazy mounts for hang gliders. He's been photographing the sport since the beginning. He's got over 50 covers in Pilot Magazine and many, many others. Done a lot of commercial work. He set the Guinness Book of World Records for looping and then did it again, beat his own record, and talks about that. Along with all the looping, John is also was also a very competitive aerobatics champion back in the day. He and Mitch went head-to-head many times, of course, but we talk about some of that history and how he got into it and chasing the skycrack from upside down. There's a lot of fun names in this one, a lot of the legends. This is, I guess, one of our legends talks, but talk about Larry Tudor and Mitch McAleer and Jack Lambie and David Kronk and a whole bunch of others, Tom Price and safety and wing testing and just a ton of good stuff. And this is, I got to talk to more of these guys. The stories could just fill an encyclopedia. So this was a lot of fun. Many thanks to Mitch McAleer for shouting me some questions on this and giving me some ideas. And I had a great trip, some great flying, and had a wonderful talk with John Heine. Enjoy.
Just talking about Larry Tudor, the fun story that I heard, I think, I don't know what year it was, but they were having a big contest in Owens Valley. And it was late in his career. And for the first time, the organizers decided to call a different kind of task than they'd ever called before. The task was from Gunter, I believe, up to the end of the range. And then normally you'd go off the end of the range to the north or northeast or east towards Tonopah. But they decided to send them east a ways and then back down the valley behind the Whites, which is, I think, Fish Lake Valley.
Yeah.
To a town, Goldfield, I believe it was.
Ghost town or something.
Yeah. And, it turned out to be a really tough task, and just about everybody landed out shortly after they turned on that southerly leg, the last southerly leg. And Larry Tudor, you know, a couple hours later,
gets it,
comes into goal. And, you know, it just points up the great talent that he had. When he was all by himself and nobody else to compete against or anything, just Mother Nature, he could make it.
He could do it. Yeah. He seemed incredibly tenacious. You know, we were down in Texas a few years ago. We were having a run at the distance record, you know, going down to a place that Osoba and all you guys found back in the day. And he just showed up. You know, there was a crew that came down from Colorado and there was Larry. He just... as psyched as ever. He just wanted to be part of an effort. And, but he's, I think he's got incredible. Yeah. There was a paraglider. He got really hurt a few years ago. Eric Reed, who was really competitive for many, many years. He's up in the Bay Area and they called him the Badger, you know, 'cause he just, when conditions got brutal and everybody sank out and nobody could survive, he'd make it.
Yeah.
You know, Larry kind of seemed like that.
Yeah. That was Larry's talent. I think he said he'd take 5 aspirin before he'd launch when he's trying to make a long flight.
For what?
I couldn't stay in the air for a long flight because it just got too painful to be prone, you know, which is not a normal position, holding your head up all that time. And
just proactively anticipating the pain?
Yeah, I think he would do that just so he could fly comfortably longer.
Wow. And,
you know, that's a little dangerous to do that kind of thing. You know, aspirin is, we used to think of it as harmless, but, you know, we know more about it now.
Right, right. I mean, wasn't he the first to break 200 and 300? He did both, didn't he?
I think so.
Yeah.
His first long one was 221. I mean, the first 200 plus. And then that 306 or something like that from Hobbs.
That one was crazy because I remember when I talked to him about that, he had it picked out where he was going to land, but he'd never been there. It was this crazy story. I think it was next to McDonald's in Kansas and from Hobbs. And, you know, he imagined he was going to land there, but he didn't know, but he'd never been there. It was, wow, pretty cool stuff.
Yeah.
Well, John, it's fantastic to be able to do this with you in person here at your shop. I already feel like I've gotten a little taste for some of the magic. I didn't know that you were a machinist. I knew about your photography background and some of your hang gliding background, which we're going to get into here, but I have a million questions for you. So why don't we start with this one? How do you describe yourself? Because you seem like a jack of many trades. Well, if you're at a party and someone walks up and, "Hi, John, what do you do?" How do you answer that?
These days, I just say I teach hang gliding, which, you know, my dad thought that if you ever got good enough at something that you could teach it, that was the best you could do in your life.
Mm.
And sadly, he didn't live long enough to see my success. At one point when the hang glider manufacturing ended and I thought about what am I going to do now, occurred to me that I've been preparing my entire adult life for being able to teach hang gliding. And, you know, a young man approached me right about that time, wanted to learn to fly. And I'd taught a couple of friends a long time ago, but I got into teaching him and decided, yeah, maybe this is what I should do now.
Huh.
And for the last 22 years or so, it's been working well for me. Not that much activity right now, but I still get enough people to stay at it. And
give us a rundown, and not in resume short form, but you feel free to lengthen it out however you want. But before we got recording here, you started in 78.
Yes.
And let's go from 78 to here. What has that journey looked like from a kind of a bird's eye view?
Oh boy. I started out on the little sand dune at Dockweiler. Friend of mine who had moved to California before me, who I'd worked with at Outboard Marine Research in Milwaukee, took me out, and his friend had a hang glider, and we tried it. You know, that's what you did back in those days. Your friend had a hang glider, you'd run down the sand dune with it and see what happened. And you know, 3 stalled crashes, and it was the biggest thrill of my life. It reminded me of when I first got up on 2 wheels on a bicycle as a little kid. It was, you know, that feeling of your world just being greatly expanded all at once by this one simple device. And I was hooked on it at that moment.
Had you seen it and stuff? Because you were here. You were in this area then?
I had seen hang gliding here and there from, actually, let's see. When I first moved to California in 72, the first thing my friends did was took me to a hang gliding event at Escape Country. And I saw these people. I mean, we pulled into this park and there were people launching these colored wings off hills all over the place, high and low hills. And I just thought, this is fantastic. And, you know, I think at that moment I knew that I wanted to spend my time doing this, but it, you know, I was in kind of a hole in the, at that time, that point in my life. And it was another 5 years before I got around to actually getting started at it myself, which is probably good because on those early gliders, I probably would have gotten killed.
Well, so, I mean, in 78, they were thermaling. I mean, the people are going places, yeah?
Not, well, in 78, yeah, that was starting to happen then, yeah. I guess, yeah.
And the carnage had certainly started by that point.
It was kind of dying off by that point, actually. The worst was around 74, I think, as far as the highest death number.
Right.
So
there was, what did it look like to learn hang gliding in 78?
From what I saw, you took one lesson and you were on your own. You were,
ready to go.
You were a pilot then. But I started out with a school in Santa Monica, and we went out to Dockweiler, and I took one lesson. I bought a glider from Iper, which was a poor glider and too small for me, and I had a hell of a time learning how to fly that thing. And because I, you know, I took two lessons and then was off on my own, and I needed a lot more than that. I was not a natural at it at all. Maybe, you know, having the wrong glider was a big part of it. But
I see all your, you know, you're a machinist here, certainly, and you got all this fancy equipment and welding stuff, and you will get into the photography. But were you an engineer coming into this? Were you bringing that kind of background to flying, or did that grow out of flying?
I went to engineering college, but I graduated on a 2-year degree, associate in applied science. And I worked at a research center for a couple of years, and then just got bored and thought I wasn't doing anything meaningful and just quit like a fool. And then I didn't know what I was going to do. I was kind of interested in motorcycles. So I have an engineering background, but I'm not considered an engineer because I didn't get a 4-year degree. And, you know, my engineering training has served me well. I mean, I really enjoyed what I learned there. And I've always been a student of science. But I've had many jobs. You know, I found that I could walk into any place that I wanted to get a job at and tell them what I could do. And I always got a job. But then, you know, once I got into hang gliding, I never had a real job again after that.
Really?
I always tried to earn some money somehow hang gliding. And, you know, I got into doing promotional photography and test flying for people making hang gliders. And you know, eventually got a steady job for a guy who wanted to become a hang glider manufacturer, and I helped him out with that. And we had a pretty good success with that company called Altair, and made the Predator and Saturn.
What years were that? Was that?
That was around 95 to 99 or 2000 or so.
Okay.
Yeah. When I first came to California to get heavily into hang gliding around 1980, I was staying with a friend, and not too far from his house was this little flying site called Salt Creek in southern Orange County, California. And when I arrived there the first time, I saw this guy named David Beardsley flying there. And he was just the smoothest pilot I could have. I mean, I haven't seen that many pilots, but the guy was so smooth and he landed so gracefully. I thought to myself, I want to fly like that guy. And I ended up flying there and observing him. And, you know, he was very generous, and he'd been flying 7 years, which I thought was
forever.
Sky God. But he was very talented and very knowledgeable, and he shared his wisdom, always mentored the new guys coming in. And he continued doing that his whole life and still does it. He still shows up at the flying site at the end of the day or when the flying starts, wherever he happens to be. And he's done a lot of traveling, and whatever flying site he happens to be at, I figure he's the de facto safety officer because he'll walk up and approach some new guy about to do something stupid, and he'll
straighten it out.
Yeah.
And let him know. That's something. A nice skill to be able to know how to do that tactfully and, make it optimistic and bring people up rather than scare them to death.
Yeah, and he has a personality that lends itself to that. And so he, I figure he's probably saved lives and certainly saved many mishaps just by giving of his knowledge to other people. And for 2024, USHPA has awarded their commendation award to David Beardsley.
Oh, really?
For what I figure is probably is a lifetime achievement kind of award for him.
Yeah. Yeah,
but he did something around 9,000 tandem flights in his career, many of them for free, just to show other people how great hang gliding was.
Wow, cool.
And that's taught several people to fly. And
your amazing photos adorn your shop here. It's history on the walls. It's fantastic. How did you get into photography?
You know, I always liked photography, cameras, pictures. You know, from an early age, I had a little Instamatic, and never really thought much about it. Probably did more documentary photos than anything. But when I got into hang gliding, I was so enthused about it, so thrilled about the idea of flying high in the air, you know, fundamental wing, that I wanted to tell other people about it. And, you know, I have to say, I saw the pictures of Leroy Granis and Eric Raymond in the Hang Gliding magazine. And I thought, that is one of the best things I've ever seen anybody do, is creating these special pictures they took mostly by mounting cameras on gliders. And I thought, I think I can do that. And with my ability to build things, I think I can make better mounts than those guys have made. And so that was really the beginning, was my thoughts about building better mounts and taking those great mounted shots. When I was first thinking about doing this mounted photography, Eric Raymond was my hero. I just wanted to be like Eric Raymond and be able to take those great shots and get them published in the magazine. So he was my role model.
You were just talking about him before with the 360, and that's kind of, I mean, he's still doing it, yeah?
Yeah, Eric Raymond is, free flight pilot's hero, because he just had a storied career of, you know, learning to hang glide and then becoming a competition pilot and a hang gliding photographer. And then when he got bored of building his own hang gliders and he decided he wanted to build an electric sailplane and fly it across the country, and he did.
He wanted to do.
Yeah. And he's still working on his two-place Sunseeker duo over in Europe, and living over there now, and putting out really nice little films of his electric sailplane. Cool. So, yeah. Cool. Yeah, he's a hero.
Yeah, cool.
Gil Dodgen was an early hang gliding enthusiast, and then he became the editor of Hang Gliding Magazine. And he was editor for many years, at least 20 years, I think, probably more. And so he was the editor pretty much through the whole 80s and 90s when I got the majority of my photographs in Hang Gliding Magazine. Mm-hmm. And I give him credit for my having become noticed as a hang gliding photographer, because without that forum to show off my photographs, who would have ever known about the pictures I took? But he liked my photos, and he printed them regularly. And I think I had not just Hang Gliding, but a few other magazines. I think I had in the neighborhood of 65 cover photos.
Whoa.
And as far as center spreads, I think it was something more like 30 or so. But
jeez, that's a lot of covers and a lot of centers.
And
that'd be any photographer would be proud of that.
Just from my watching Hang Gliding magazine over those years, I think it's probably a record.
Oh yeah, that'll never be beat. That's Kelly Slater stuff right there. That'll never be beat. That's amazing.
Here's kind of a funny one. I had this idea to take a picture stepping on the nose of another glider as I flew over. And, you know, Torrey Pines is the obvious place to do that. So a friend of mine, David Friend, known as RC Dave, agreed to help me with that picture. So he was flying one of my TRXs and I was flying the other one. I had the camera mounted on my wing and I mounted it in vertical format just to have plenty of room to get the other glider below. And plus I thought might make a nice cover shot. And so we went out and did the shot and we got it, you know, it worked. It was pretty easy to do. And Gil Dodgen put it on the cover of the magazine. And the next month, somebody wrote in a letter to the editor, that's a dangerous picture you put on the cover. You shouldn't be showing dangerous things like that on the cover of our magazine. And so the following month, RC Dave wrote in a letter to the editor and said, he said, I had one hand on my parachute, the other hand over my eyes. Tell your readers to quit whining.
It was all under control. That's terrific. There's something about people who are drawn to this sport that I haven't really landed on the why too much. I live in a town where backcountry skiing's a big deal and, you know, pretty extreme mountain biking's a big deal. I run around with guys who are, you know, take some pretty heavy risks and they have no desire to fly whatsoever. Isn't that interesting? What is it about guys like you who just were drawn to it and this is what you had to do? I just had this conversation with Tom Pagini, you know, he used to fly with you back and still as passionate about it today as he's ever been.
Yeah.
He just loves flight.
I don't know the answer. It's just probably a human psychology thing where people think that as long as they're close to the ground, they're safer. Really in flying, everybody in flying knows that the only time you're in danger is when you're close to the ground. So it's probably just a typical mistaken idea that people have about flying that and about dangerous things that, you know, if you're kind of sort of connected to the ground, you're not in danger. I don't know.
It's interesting, isn't it?
I was in New York doing some towing with Paul Voigt and his group. They were truck towing at, I think, an airport called Blue Swan. And there was a young instructor there, and he had some students there who were doing their first towing. This young man was going to do his first tow, and I said, where's your parachute? And he said, oh, I don't have one yet. I've ordered it, but my instructor told me I could fly without it until it gets in. And I said, can't tow without a parachute. And he said, oh, well, let me ask my instructor. And he called the instructor, and the instructor said, oh, yeah, it came in. And I said, let's put it in your harness right now. So I put it in his harness, got it all ready. And he towed, first tow flight, behind a trike. And we're watching him tow, and they're about maybe 500 feet up. And all of a sudden, the hang glider and the trike are both going down like this, tow line still attached.
Whoa.
And the student threw his parachute, and the line broke, weak link broke or something. The trike ended up pulling out and flying away. Everybody was all right. And the student came down under that brand new parachute.
Holy boy, he was lucky he came across you. Holy cow. What happened?
Somebody stalled. I suspect the student maybe got too slow and slowed the trike.
And then they were both recovering from a stall. Gotcha. Wow. Holy cow. That was lucky.
Yeah.
Incredibly lucky.
He called me a year later on his birthday and thanked me.
I bet. I bet he did. He owes that birthday to you.
Yeah.
I have another generalization. This isn't always true, but it seems that people, when they get into the sport, are drawn towards one aspect of the sport or another. It could be acrobatics, in your case, aerobatics, or cross country, or neither, really. You could be ridge soaring at Torrey for your career. As I understand it, you were kind of the modern inventor of aerobatics. Talk about that. What was spinning your mind that you wanted to make these things do things that they weren't, quote unquote, supposed to do?
Well, big correction. I was in no way an inventor or originator of aerobatics. Most people give that to Dan Racanelli.
Okay.
He was doing really beautiful maneuvers back in the single surface days. And of course, Mitch McAleer was doing aerobatics before I.
Okay. I had that backwards then. I thought Mitch came after yours.
No, I learned a lot about aerobatics by watching Mitch and analyzing his videos. And I really tried to emulate what he did. And one of the biggest compliments of my life was when he saw me do loops for the first time, and he was kind of, he was surprised, and he said, "You look like me."
That was a big thrill.
So, but I watched Eric Raymond. Eric Raymond was probably one of the guys. I didn't see him do loops very much, but one day I was standing at Edwards, and he was up not all that high, and all of a sudden he just pulled in and dove and did this loop, and it looked so easy. I thought, well, I know it's not easy, but once you learn what you need to know, that looked easy. It's got to be something that's quite doable. And then Wayne Denny, Crazy Wayne, also gave me good pointers that really helped me out. He was looping fledges, which is a little different, but still had some good advice for me. And, of course, Ron Young was... he was a monster at aerobatics. The guy had longer than normal arms, which is a perfect situation for doing aerobatics on hang gliders, because you can pull in, get your body weight further forward, And he was strong guy, too. He was just like the muscle man of aerobatics. He forced the glider to do what he wanted to. And so all those guys, were before me. Probably the only reason I got famous at aerobatics was because I started mounting cameras and getting those upside down pictures, and then video, 16 millimeter cameras of Tom Sanders. One year I got to fly in a air show on the Chicago lakefront. My friends Greg and Audrey Fisher were very much into hang gliding organization back then, and they got us, a group of hang gliders, into the air show that they were putting on, Chicago Air and Water Show. And so the day before the show, we were practicing at Miggs Field. There was an executive airport right on the lakefront in those days. And Greg and Audrey thought it'd be a fun thing to rent a limousine and come out and do our towing that day with a limousine. And so we were towing up just to do some practice stuff at a towered field, Miggs Field. And we were there by permission, of course. And so we did some flights. And late in the day, I noticed that there was a nice I think I took a flight and was up and saw that this nice sunset was starting to happen behind the Chicago skyline. And I thought that would make a fantastic picture. I need to, and I was totally into aerobatic shots at that time. So I thought I need to do a loop and get a picture of that Chicago skyline with the sun setting in the background. And so I got the camera all set up on the glider and I towed up. And, you know, we were limited as to how far we were towed. We were doing a static line tow, and the runway wasn't that long. So I was up, I don't know how far, but it was enough to do a loop. So I dove, and I did my loop, and as usual, I just pushed the button and held it, you know, thinking that I would get three or four shots as I went over, and one of them would be the shot, which was my habit at that time. So as I went over and got quiet, as I did, went over the top on the loop, I noticed I didn't hear the camera clicking, and I knew I hadn't gotten the shot. And then I remembered I had put the camera on single shot when I gave it to somebody else to take pictures of me. So I thought, oh man, I leveled out. I'm looking at the ground. I knew I needed to do another loop and get that shot, but I thought I'm too low. And I looked at that gorgeous scene behind me, and I wanted it so badly, I thought, I got to get it. I dove. And I...
What could go wrong?
Yeah. And probably getting close to the ground, I pulled up a little early, and I was concentrating on timing the pushing of the button at just the right time, and I pushed the button, and I started falling into the sail.
Oh, God.
And, you know, people talk about an out-of-body experience. I learned about out-of-body experiences that day. When that happened, I knew that I was in a bad situation because I thought I wasn't high enough to recover from a stall. Yeah. So it felt like I was sitting alongside, almost riding tandem with the guy flying the glider. And I said, you really screwed up this time. You don't have room to get out of this. But the guy flying the glider did all he could do, just hauled the bar in and dove for the ground. And by the time I got towards the ground, I was back in my body again, and I pulled up going probably 60 miles an hour, 5 feet off the tarmac. And I had just enough energy to pull up, turn 90 degrees to the left, and mush over a Cessna and land into the wind.
Did you get the shot?
I got the shot. Yeah! And it was in the calendar the next year. So the guy who was the operator of the airport was in the tower at the time, and he comes down and walks up to me as I was getting my harness off and had a big smile on his face and said, did you mean to do that? And I said, no, that was the closest I've ever come to smacking myself on the tarmac.
Well, that would have been unsurvivable. Holy cow.
Yeah,
wow, that's amazing. I've never heard that's... That's a remarkably low save. We talk about low saves, but that's a different kind of low save.
Yeah, it was.
From in your sail to landing it. You couldn't have been more than, what, 50 feet off the deck?
Oh, when I was upside down?
Yeah.
Oh, no, I was much higher than that.
Okay.
It takes more than that to get the... But the thing is, see, that's the hint that what Wayne Denny told me before I did my first loop, he said, it's okay as long as you get upside down. If you get flat upside down, the way the glider is designed, you keep your weight forward. You've got less surface area in front and more weight, more surface area in the back. So the nose is going to come down. Mm. So you'll be stalled and you'll be dropping like a rock and you'll be in a, you know, the fastest dive you've ever been in. But you'll come through and you'll still be flying. You won't tumble as long as you get flat upside down.
Mm.
And so that gave me the confidence to go ahead and experiment with the first time.
Wow. Amazing.
Yeah.
What was your loop record, the Guinness one?
Oh, yeah. 52 loops after dropping out of a hot air balloon around 12,000 feet up at El Mirage Dry Lake. Tom Sanders made that whole project happen. He organized the Guinness people to film it, and he did the aerial filming for it. And that was a great project, great fun. And
what year was that?
That would have been 86. 87. Oh, no, 88. I think that was on the Red Mystic.
What does it stand at now?
Well, I had the record for 9 years, and then I did another attempt in Florida, which I extended it only to 58, because the turbo tug that was taking me up hadn't tried towing that high before and got out on oil temperature, high oil temperature indication. And so I had to pin off low. And but then the next year, McAleer did 71 or 77, I believe, 77 down in Rio de Janeiro. And then I think only a year or so after that, Chad Elchins did 95. He towed up to 15,000 feet, I think, and did 95.
Wow.
So that's the record now. You know, Mitch is the only living pilot who has, you know, the highest number.
Is, forgive my lack of knowledge with hang gliding in history, is aerobatics, as I'm going to put this in parens here, as safe in hang gliding as it is in paragliding? It's kind of an interesting thing that in paragliding, the acro crew they don't have a lot of accidents, and they get, it's really, really, really good training for any kind of cross country paragliding. And cross country pilots need to do as much as they possibly can, because it teaches you wing control and ground relation and just awareness.
Yeah.
Was that the case in hang gliding as well, or were you taking on some huge risk?
I've taught a number of aerobatics seminars, and most of the people who attend them aren't really thinking about getting to the point where they do loops, but they know that it's a good safety idea to know how to get out of a bad situation if you find yourself. Because, you know, anybody can get flipped upside down in a radical thermal.
Mm-hmm.
It's good to have some practice and experience at doing wingovers and getting into some unusual attitudes and how to get out if it goes wrong.
You've done a lot of traveling all over the world to fly. Was that for aerobatics competitions? Was that for cross-country competitions? Was that just for fun?
I didn't have the stamina I needed for cross-country competitions. They became Ironman contests in the, you know, mid-80s. And I got into aerobatics just again, watching the guys who I saw around Elsinore. Elsinore seemed to be a hotbed for guys interested in aerobatics. And interestingly, none of those early guys, Dangerous Dave Gibson, Ron Young, Mitch McAleer, Eric Raymond, none of them wanted to tell me anything about aerobatics, because I think they were afraid that, you know, they'd be responsible if I got hurt. And so they were pretty much, you know, quiet about it. I had to figure things out by watching them.
Break in.
Yeah. But as I said, Wayne Denny gave me probably the best advice I ever got about it.
It's interesting that, you know, you and Roy and Mitch, and you've all kind of made this your place. What is it that's so special about flying here for the audience who haven't flown here in this area? You know, I mean, this is kind of the birth, as I understand, of flying in the U.S. Well, I mean, Kitty Hawk, of course, the other side, but, you know, what's kept you here? What's been the magic of these mountains, these ranges?
It started in Southern California, certainly, but I've lived in Utah, and I really think Utah is the best place I've ever lived for flying hang gliders, paragliders. But Southern California, you know, you can fly year-round.
Mm.
Any day of the year, winter or summer, can be soarable. You know, less soarable days in the winter, of course. But also, I don't like the cold. You know, I get cold easily, and it's better to be here. I really should go spend winters in Costa Rica, probably.
There's nice flying down there.
Yeah.
It's pretty.
But, yeah, that's... As far as world traveling, Most of the times I've gone has been to do demonstrations at some event. You know, I think it was 96. What was his name? Guy in, an organizer guy in Portugal brought me over to do aerobatics at two events he was running. He was running the Portuguese Nationals and the Spanish Nationals on some mountains up in northern Portugal, right close to the border of Spain. And after the event was over, he and I were flying, we were the only two guys in the air. The previous days, the air was filled with gliders. Well, he and I are flying just thermaling for the fun of it. And I was downrange a ways by this windmill, thinking there would be a thermal there. And I was up at a good altitude, and I'm just kind of flying out away from the ridge a little bit in some pretty good wind. So I was kind of just hanging there. And I look over to my left, and I see a hawk down below, just right next to me, doing the same thing. And got this crazy idea, and I just pulled in and dove and did a loop right next to him. And I pulled up, leveled out, and I looked over. He was above me a little bit at this time, and he dove and did a loop.
Get out of here.
And
that's awesome.
I was, you know, I didn't expect that to happen, but I saw it with my own eyes, and I have no proof of it, but I have to believe that. You know, I've never seen a hawk do a loop, and I don't know if I've ever seen any bird do it, but
that is cool. You went, oh, that's a good idea. You know, I did an interview a while back with a gal who, now she is a pilot, but at the time she was just studying migratory birds, and she was making the argument that birds don't play. It doesn't make sense for them to, because flying takes energy, and energy is only replenished through eating.
Yeah.
And I said, no, you have to learn how to fly, because every pilot in the world knows that birds play. We see it all the time. They definitely play. And she was saying, no, that doesn't make any scientific sense. I promise you that they're playing, because that we see it all the time.
Well, it's a logical hypothesis from her point of view.
Absolutely.
Yeah, but
I should check in with her now, because I know now she has become a pilot. So if you're listening to this, I'll ring you back up. But yeah, I mean, we see birds play all the time. Just purely for the fun of it.
We do. In fact, at Torrey Pines, you know, you see the ravens will dive and they'll roll upside down and then roll back the same.
Yeah.
I finally saw one roll and continue and go all the way
all
over.
All the way through.
Which is very rare. They usually go upside down and then back.
Right.
I went to Norway in 2004 to teach a class on aerobatics. There were eight guys there who had been practicing and were ready to get on with looping, and it was pretty rewarding. I watched a few of them do their first loops.
Oh, cool.
Yeah. But been to Japan 3 times, and that was always for aerobatic demos at contests, hang gliding contests back then. Mm. But when I went to the Black Forest region of Germany, probably, I don't know, it was 10, 12 years ago, I realized at that point, when there were just a few of us hang glider pilots flying the site and about 60 paragliders, they were having a contest, of course, but made me realize that that's what hang gliding is about now, doing demonstrations at paragliding events. So,
where do you think hang gliding's going, if you could predict, in 10 years? You think there could be a resurgence? You think it could, you know, there, like you said, I'm showing up at sites in certain parts of the world where it's still pretty popular. You know, like you said, you've got students coming.
Yeah.
What do you think? You can rub your crystal ball.
The way I see it happening is kind of maybe like a dystopian novel. We'll go long enough without enough people interested in hang gliding that all the manufacturers will have to close because they just don't have enough business, can't afford to do R&D anymore. And then at that time, sometime after that, I think that there will be a resurgence of interest in hang gliding, and people will be looking around in Grandpa's garage for a hang glider that might be hanging up in there. And that's where they'll get their hang gliders from, old gliders like my collection, where
you got about 40 back there, you said.
Yeah, where they'll people will be looking for old hang gliders, and you know, somebody will be lucky enough to find one that was flown once and put away, and it's brand new. Perfect. And then there'll be old ratty ones that they'll have to do repairs on, maybe even make new sails, and it'll be a really interesting community of creative and talented people who will resurrect these old gliders and learn to fly them.
And
it might even be illegal by that time. Right. So all the flying that'll be done will be bandito, you know, and you'll be running from the authorities. And,
right. And be like base jumping off buildings as now. You know?
Exactly.
It'll be all done in the middle of the night.
So it could make for an interesting story.
Are you, many of your brethren have made the jump over, you know, Mitch goes both ways still and stuff, but, have you toyed with paragliding as well? Have you spent any time flying the rags?
Yeah. Friend of mine, Scott Gressett, was, working for people importing paragliders in the early days, and he, got me started in it, and it was great fun. I loved soaring little coastal cliffs with paraglider, and light thermals I thought were fine too, but a little freaked out. They were pretty collapsy back in those days. Mm. And we're talking about the late 80s, early 90s. And I, you know, the first time I ever flew at Torrey Pines, I had a half-wing collapse and didn't know what to do. And, you know, I was about 15 feet up is all, and so rotated 180 and hit on the ground on a hard plywood seat, and did a compression fracture of my T12 vertebra. And so I was out for 4 months. And when I got back into flying, I flew paragliders a couple times, but yeah, I didn't really get back into it, mainly because UP, the company I was working for at the time, was ending their operations in the U.S. and stopped importing paragliders, so I didn't have free paragliders to fly anymore.
Tell me about your design history, you know, UP, and what were you doing? You mentioned you were a test pilot. Were you mostly test piloting? Were you mostly designing?
The first guy I helped work on hang gliders, he was designing and building his own gliders in his garage in Gardena, California. Not Gardena, Garden Grove. And his name was George Dyer, and he was a Texan who had been a four-times world champion at flat kite flying, where they towed these big flat kites behind boats before regalos were developed. He got into hang gliding, of course. He was an engineer, and I ran into him at Crestline one day and ended up getting to know him. And he was building these gliders he called the Hawks, the double surface gliders in the early days of double surface. And so I wasn't much of a help to him as far as designing at that time, but I did test fly his gliders for him. And later, when I made my first looping glider, I was involved with Bill Bennett up at Delta Wing Gliders up in Van Nuys. And I wanted a glider like Eric Raymond had that he was looping. He had taken a Comet and put an extra rib in between each normal rib station and a few other modifications. And he had a nice looping glider. So I just asked Bill Bennett if I could do the same thing to a Mystic sail. He had the Mystic at the time. And so I did that, and I didn't know Eric well at all at that time, but I looked at his glider and made a few other changes on the glider, bigger leading edge tubes, bigger crossbars, and a high hang point, king post hang point, which was in the early days of that. And the thing just happened to work out great for looping. It was easy glider to loop. dive it for about 3 seconds and start letting out, and you had your loop. Later, I got the chance to develop gliders with Dick Cheney up in Utah, who'd been building hang gliders since the early days and had gotten involved with the Japanese who owned UP at the time. And they set up a company to build gliders, and I got on with them doing demo tours and doing promotional photography for them, which I had done for Delta Wing. And so when that all fell through, and it was just Dick Cheney and I there, I asked Dick if he would let me take the TRX and do some things to it to make a better glider. I think he was sick of hang gliding by that time, but to his credit, he went ahead and really went all out to help me with that project. And he was the sailmaker, you know, and he was a genius at hardware. And together we came up with some really nice stuff for that glider and made the Predator and then later the Saturn sizes. And so that, you know, lasted a few years, and we had great fun at it. Peter Radman was the guy who bought the rights to make the Predator after, you know, Dick and I had developed it. And so we had the company Altair for a few years. And, you know, we all had a good time doing that. But as with most hang glider companies, it wasn't destined to last long.
And what was the death knell, as it say? What was the state of the industry pre the first paragliders? Was it already really declining, splitting apart? Because I know there was just a lot of companies coming and going.
Yeah, you know, by the time paragliding came around, it was down to a few basic companies who were making hang gliders. Will's Wing in the United States, Trampinaw, I think, was kind of towards the end of his run, making the sensors. Cameron Blevins was pretty much just getting started making his gliders, and he made great hang gliders. He did some really good contributions to hang gliding. But, you know, the foreign manufacturers, Icaro and Moyes, and the ones in Germany and UK, they were all still doing well, I believe. But I think what really led hang gliding in the wrong direction was this idea that you always have to keep making them higher performance, mm-hmm. This concentration on competition. And then whatever the competition pilots were flying, all the rest of the regular weekend warriors had to fly in order to feel worthy. Mm. And so when the gliders got into the topless realm, I just saw that. I never wanted to build a topless Predator. I just thought it was a step too far in complexity, cost of repair, complexity of repair, weight of the glider. And they didn't handle very well initially. It just seemed like the wrong direction to go. And I think that's what really was what set hang gliding on the decline, was same thing that put sailplanes on the decline. You know, once sailplanes got to be 60-to-1 glide ratio and cost, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars, yeah. It, you know, not everybody could afford those. And so there goes your customer base. Mm. So I think that's what happened to hang gliding, really.
This is the big conversation right now in the World Cup, is you have to, you know, if you don't have the sub harness and you don't have this year's hottest glider, I mean, the Enzo 3 has been kind of dominant now for many years, but it's the same thing. We're going to go the same route if everybody's got to have that stuff, because it's expensive.
Yeah.
And it's fragile and it breaks, and then you get another one, and it's pretty hard to be competitive without it. Interesting. We've got the history books to look at to, you know, make yeah. better decisions.
Well, I think paragliding is going to stick around for a long time. Seems to me that most paraglider pilots realize they have to stick with a glider that's reasonable to fly from a safety standpoint. And, you know, even in hang gliding, the topless gliders were quite safe. They, you know, they did their same testing that they did on all the hang gliders ever developed for strength and stability. So it wasn't really a safety aspect unless you consider having to land one of those things. You know, they were harder to land because they just glide forever.
Coming in hot.
Yeah. So, but paragliding has a better chance of surviving it, I think.
Well, it was interesting what I think the Red Bull X-Alps and then most recently COVID, I think, really drove people to hiking. You know, it shut all the lifts down in Europe. And so everybody, to stay sane, they had to go outside and go do something. And so there's been this wave of lighter gear technology and improvements. And so people can walk up hills. And that seems to be, that's a nice, it's helped things, I think, stay growing. Not probably growing very fast, but it's brought in more interest from people who normally wouldn't do it.
That's a great obvious advantage of paragliding, is the hikeability.
Yeah, carry stuff. Yeah.
I have friends who carried, one friend I'm thinking of, Steve Aden, used to carry his glider up to the top of the Butte where he lived in Oregon. And he would be up there soaring when his friends down at the Normal launch down below couldn't fly because it wasn't soarable down there yet, but he would throw his 38-pound glider on his shoulder and hike up there. And
dedication.
But, you know, gliders got to be to where they're, most of the gliders that are strong enough to be safe are, you know, 55, 60, 65 pounds these days, and I have been for a long time. And that's, you know, we really should do something to make gliders, hang gliders, lighter. But now it's a little late. There's no customer base to make it worth doing development. So, the weight of the glider is another factor.
I just watched Oppenheimer. I don't know if you've seen the film, but there's this, when they're creating this bomb, there's a lot of science, but there's a lot of unknown still. And there's this moment where, and they're going, hey, when we light this thing up, we don't know if it's just going to keep going and incinerate the atmosphere. And there's, you know, I'm sure some of that's Hollywood, but I think there's some historical basis to that. They really didn't know, as an atomic bomb. When you guys were getting, this isn't a perfect comparison, but when you guys were, you know, the first person who looped, was there a, is this thing going to hold together? Is it going to, there's quite a bit of force there, isn't there?
Yeah, well, thankfully for me, Racanelli and, you know, other guys found that out ahead of time, so I didn't have to worry about
it. So it wasn't a complete crapshoot when you were building a glider to loop, that you knew the basics of what it had to do.
Yeah, no, okay. I kept the basic parts of the glider, you know, stock, or at least I knew that I was making them stronger than stock. So yeah, that wasn't anything I was concerned about.
The guys who set the infinite records on a paraglider, looping on a paraglider, it's you know, they talk about the physicalness required of it, you know, the G-force and the whiplash in your neck, and it looks smooth, quite a bit smoother on a hang glider. But how fit did you have to be to loop 70 something times? Was there a lot of physical training involved before you did it? And
as I recall, too close to the project, I decided, you know, maybe I should do some pull-ups and get my muscles built up. And so I actually hurt myself by trying to train too soon before the event, too close to the event. And my arms were sore for days after that, after that run. But, you know, I guess I was just in good enough shape. I've never been much of an athlete, but I had enough being 30 years old or whatever I was.
What gets you excited about flying these days?
Mostly shooting video, you know. Mm-hmm. Again, the idea of showing other people how cool it is and what a thrill it is to be up there and how beautiful it can be. Mm-hmm. You know, you're always trying to get the sunset shots or the beautiful stormy cloud shots and shots close to other gliders and you know, doing touch and goes and whatever trickery and clowning you can come up with. So yeah, I'm just mainly trying to make the hang gliding movies that I always dreamed about, even way back in the 80s, but never really got the chance to do. And now I've got all the equipment to do it that I need myself to film and edit the things. I just have to get friends to help me and fly with me, and I'll come up with some nice movies.
Telluride. Tell me about Telluride. There's a mysticism behind that place. I think most hang gliders that have flown in the States, you guys used to have comps out there. You had aerobatics comps out there too, right?
Yeah.
The green machine and all this stuff. That there's mysticism there. Is there something that many people have not flown Telluride? Even these days, it's not flown a ton. It's way up high. What is it about that place?
I think most of us who went there had never been to such a beautiful little mountain village as was there. And then to get up on launch at 12,250 feet and look at those great peaks above the timberline all around you, it was just spectacular. And then to have, a couple hundred other hang glider pilots show up in town and all going up on trucks to fly every day. It was, you got to socialize with other people who were passionate about what you were. And then they always had that aerobatics contest, from the early days. They were, the Telluride Air Force people called their contest the World Aerobatics Championships. Nobody else in the world was doing anything like it. So I figure they had the right to call it that, even though there was no official sanctioning from anyone.
Right.
And they did it for so long, every year in a row, that gave them credibility. And it was everybody there was just like floating on air, literally, because they were just having this great experience of getting together with like-minded people.
Mm. You mentioned the one accident on a paraglider. Have there been others along the way? Have you been pretty lucky? Have you been?
I've been very lucky. Yeah, I have had hang gliding accidents. Seemed like every couple of years from the time I started, I had some mishap. But I was always lucky enough to get out of it with a minor injury, a recoverable injury, I guess I can't deny that I'm a bold pilot. But and there are old bold pilots, but they exist only by luck.
Mm.
And you can't count on luck. I tell my students, it's good to be lucky, but the only luck you can count on is that which you've had in the past.
Better lucky than good. That's Nate, my buddy Nate Skills, likes to say all the time. You instruct. You've had 45 years or 46 years of flying. I think if I did the math right there, what do you try to pass on to those who are getting started and have no understanding of what they're getting into? Really? I mean, it's we're all ignorant for quite a long time.
Yeah. I feel that I'm my main job is to keep them from getting hurt while they're learning to fly. And it's hard to know how to do that. Had a pretty good safety record. Haven't killed anybody yet. Had a few broken bones. Yeah, it's just, I start out on a very shallow training slope that's so shallow that a person can't possibly get into a turn and turn downwind before they hit the ground.
Mm.
So that takes out the prospect of a downwind crash. And we do 100 to 150 takeoffs and landings on that that shallow slope before progressing to a higher launch. And I've had people do over 200 takeoffs and landings on the shallow slope. And then, it's always a little nerve-wracking to send them off a higher launch for the first time. But in most cases, it's intuitive enough, the control of the glider is intuitive enough that most people just pretty much get onto it right away. Mm. Try to do tandems, at least one tandem with a student before, an hour-long tandem at Torrey Pines or Crestline if possible to get them, you know, satisfy myself that they're doing the right thing controlling the glider. And then, you know, in the next flight, they're off the mountain on their own. And that's worked mostly.
Tell me about when you're sitting here looking at all these amazing photos. You said you recently did a presentation, and it's so easy to tell stories when you see, you know, all the images you've taken over all these years and video all these years. Pulling out that is still very memorable for you, just in terms of there I was. What an amazing, you know, wouldn't it be nice to... That's the coolest thing to me about flight is we never do the same thing twice. It's always different. Now, there's always something different about the air and the sky and the light and the time and where you are in the headspace. But is there a particular flight that just really stands out?
Probably the one that stands out the most is the one that hurt me the most. Mm. I had this idea that I wanted to take a picture with the camera mounted on the wing of the glider while flying over a body of water with my finger stuck in the water as I glided over. I just thought it'd be a cool shot. And I think it was Dan Racanelli's, actually it was a guy named, was it John Minnick, I think, who took that picture of Dan Racanelli gliding over low over a lake.
Man, that reflection's beautiful.
Yeah.
Wow.
And so the idea of having the glider reflected on the water, and then I thought the extra little thing for it would be to put your finger in the water. And so I planned to do that at Lake Elsinore. And my plan was to take off in sled ride conditions with the camera on the glider, mount it, fly out over the water, and turn around and glide back towards shore and dive, get up some diving speed so I could plane out over the water and have a few seconds, several seconds to, you know, get my finger in the water before I landed on shore. So, you know, I chose to put the camera all the way at the tip, which was a mistake from a safety standpoint. It made a nicer picture. But and then before I launched, I thought, you know, I've got it counterbalanced with a weight, but the drag of that camera out on the tip just could make the glider kind of hard to control. So I think I taped a tin can on the opposite tip of the glider just to create some drag out there. And I told myself I was going to practice dives on the way out. And if it didn't, the glider didn't feel really controllable, I wasn't going to do it. I would just cancel. Well, of course, I got out there and I did the test run and it wasn't right. It still yawed to the right pretty badly. And
where the camera was?
Yeah.
Yeah. So and you didn't have enough drag in the can. It wasn't
exactly
enough.
Okay. So I ended up going for it anyway, like a fool. and I don't know that hurt me, but I... everything worked out great. I dove. I got my speed up, my energy built. I pulled up just over the water. I had already arranged to have the button for the camera right in the middle of the base tube so I could put one hand on the middle of the base tube and not have the glider turn on me. And then I put my finger down and went in the water up to the first knuckle, and then it came out again right away. And I thought, oh, maybe I didn't get the picture. So I thought, my first foolish thought was, oh, I'm going to pull in a little bit to get down close to the water and, you know, go for another try. And I learned a lesson there about aerodynamics. and that is, when you're gliding along at a certain glide angle and for the speed you're going, if you lower the angle of attack, the glider drops some altitude instantly before it settles into the new glide angle. And, you know, when you're up high, you don't notice that little bit of loss of altitude. But when you're within arm's reach of the ground, yeah, when you're within arm's reach of the surface, it becomes quite obvious that you lose some altitude. And the base tube hit the water, and I slammed through. I was probably going 50 miles an hour.
Ooh.
And fortunately, the water was only a couple feet deep. My head went through the bottom surface of the sail and did some damage to my larynx. I couldn't talk for a month and a half. Spent the night in the hospital. But if the water had been deeper, I would have drowned. Or if I'd gotten knocked out, I would have drowned. So it was an expensive photograph.
I'll see.
And, you know, I get a lot of compliments on the picture, but it certainly wasn't worth doing.
Ooh. Was that similar, doing very different things? You know, Mitch was doing the show over in, was it Austria when he did that?
Yeah.
And it was his third loop. And, man, the footage of that is just, you know, 50 miles an hour to zero is that's a heavy hit.
Yeah, he might have been going faster than that, too.
He was moving. He might have been going faster. You're right. But holy smokes, that's a hard stop.
That would have killed a normal man.
Yeah, Mitch, he does have some superhumanness in him, that's for sure. That is some incredible footage.
Those
of you listening, I'll put that up in the show notes again. That is amazing.
That's hard to watch.
Oh, God. It's terrifying. You've got some history in motorcycles, yeah?
Oh, just, you know, I watched the movie Easy Rider, and I just liked that idea of the chopper and going on long motorcycle trips. So I got an old Harley and built a chopper and actually went to work for a guy in Torrance, California, another one of those places where I walked in and decided I want to work here, and I told the guy what I could do. It was a custom motorcycle shop, Walker's Engine and Frame, a guy named Ed Walker, and I was enthusiastic about this stuff, and I knew how to weld and build things, and so he hired me as his frame builder and welder, and I worked there for a fair amount of time and had a lot of fun, and built my old Harley.
You like building things. You're also fascinated with, what did Mitch call it? Diesel rabbits.
Yeah.
Well, this is the Volkswagen Rabbit, right?
Yeah, that's, I bought a brand new diesel rabbit in 1980. My friend Gary Bakley and I went to Oshkosh, the air show one year around 1980, and we drove his little 78 diesel rabbit up there, and he let me drive it on the way home, and it drove nicely, and it got 55 miles per gallon. And I thought, I'm going to get one of these because I'm getting into hang gliding, and I want to be able to drive wherever I want to go without the guilt of wasting fuel. Fuel was cheap back then.
Yeah.
So I bought a brand new one and drove it 379,000 miles, and it got 55 miles per gallon, and I bought a van after that. But then when I got back down here to Southern California, I started finding these used diesel rabbits, and I'm on the fifth one now. and you know, when I find something that works for me, I stick with it.
That's 44 years of rabbits.
Yeah, right.
That's 2 years less than you've been flying. That's very impressive.
It's a great little efficient automobile, and I know how to work on it myself. So I just keep going and don't think about buying. I think about buying a new car once in a while, but then I procrastinate on it and forget about it.
Looking back, you know, when you're editing your films and thinking about all your years in the sport, anything that you wish could have gone differently? Let me phrase that a different way. If you could have talked to your 78 self, you know, when in 78, however old you were at that time, and said, "Hey, John, here's what you need to know," what would you have told yourself?
Yeah, I've had my mishaps and injuries, but the way my life has gone, I don't think I'd change anything because I just feel good about my life right now. I never made much money, but I've made some accomplishments, some satisfying accomplishments. I just I enjoy my life as it is. If I did anything differently, you know, any little change could have changed a lot of stuff.
Jeff Shapiro said, when I had him on, he said almost the same thing. He said, I wouldn't change anything for fear of changing everything.
Yeah, that's right.
That's a nice way to put it.
Good way to put it. Yeah. Yeah, Jeff is a cool guy. You know, in the earliest of days, I would obviously say a bunch of things about how hang gliding works, and maybe I've avoided a few of my mishaps and injuries just from being illiterate about it. Again, you know,
That's how you learn.
It's a meaningless question because you can't.
Yeah.
Can't go back and tell yourself.
Right.
But I guess, you know, the point is you can tell other people who are starting out. And to that point, just be very conscious about safety, you know, and decide whether it's a day to fly or not based on conditions and how you feel, because it's much better to miss a flying day and be able to fly again the next day than to fly in the wrong conditions, get hurt or killed.
Yeah, I don't think I've heard too many people that have been hurt go, yeah, I wish I, you know, I wish I'd flown.
Yeah, right.
You just fly the next day, be fine.
Yeah. An interesting aspect to my learning to fly, and I think the one person who's maybe more responsible for my accomplishing what I have in hang gliding is an old gal named Elsie Garut, who lived down the street from me when I first lived in San Clemente, California. And I got to know her because I was doing electrical jobs to earn my rent and food money at the time. And I ended up doing some little electrical repairs for her and her husband. They lived several houses down the street. And so I got to know them. And after her husband died, she told me that I could use her spare bedroom in her house. She was living alone. And so I moved into her spare bedroom, didn't have to pay rent for the next few years. That meant I didn't have to work very much, and I could go flying almost every day. And I think that is why I, you know, gained the skills I could to win some aerobatics contest. Yeah. And, you know, I cooked meals for her and took her places. She was legally blind. And so, you know, it was a symbiosis.
Yeah.
But it was great. And she loved me like a grandson. And, you know, I think it was Spanish Joe who told me one time that John Pendry was just a normal hang glider pilot, just another pilot in England, until he got a sponsorship and didn't have to work. And he had a girlfriend who drove for him. And so he could fly every day, and he could try going cross country on any day, even if it wasn't a great looking day. He just left and went cross country because his girlfriend would always pick him up. So it was convenient. And Spanish Joe said that was when John Pendry went from an average pilot to being world class.
Yeah.
And so that's a similar situation. I, of course, didn't have a girlfriend to drive for me, so.
Well, my wife drove for me at the time, my girlfriend, she drove for me once. And near the end of the day, when we were on our way back, she said, Gavin, I want you to know that I'll never do that again. And she never has.
I have a friend who whose girlfriend was really enthusiastic about his hang gliding. She wrote poems about it. She made drawings and made picture books and stuff to give him. And the day they got married, she never drove for him again.
Yes, there is pre-marriage and after. My wife now, who is amazing, she also, until we got married, she listened to every one of these podcasts. Hasn't listened to one since. She's very supportive of the flying, but she's not going to pick me up, and she's not going to listen to the podcast.
Makes sense.
John, thank you for your time and sharing all these fantastic stories with myself and the audience, and sharing your little nook of the world here. This is a cool shop. I appreciate it. And I appreciate all your photos and all your contributions to the sport. And you're quite understated. I think But we got to have a nice journey there with you. Thank you very much.
Nice to talk with you.
If you find the Cloud-Based Mayhem valuable, you can support it in a lot of different ways. You can give us a rating on iTunes or Stitcher, or however you get your podcast. That goes a long ways and helps spread the word. You can blog about it on your own website or share it on social media. You can talk about it on the way up to launch with your pilot friends. I know a lot of interesting conversations have happened that way. And of course, you can support us financially. This show does take a lot of time, a lot of editing, a lot of storage and music and all kinds of behind the scenes cost. So if you can support us financially, all we've ever asked for is a buck a show. And you can do that through a one-time donation through PayPal, or you can set up a subscription service that charges you for each show that comes out. We put a new show out every 2 weeks. So, for example, if you did a buck a show and every 2 weeks, it'd be about $25 a year. So way cheaper than a magazine subscription, and it makes all of this possible. I do not want to fund this show with advertising or sponsors. We get asked about that pretty frequently, but for a whole bunch of different reasons, which I've said many times on the show, I don't want to do that. I don't like having that stuff at the front of the show. And I also want you to know that these are authentic conversations with real people, and these are just our opinions, but our opinions are not being skewed by sponsors or advertising dollars. I think that's a pretty toxic business model. So I hope you dig that. You can support us. If you go to cloudbasedmayhem.com, you can find the places to support. You can do it through patreon.com/cloudbasedmayhem. If you want a recurring subscription, you can also do that directly through the website. We've tried to make it really easy, and that will give you access to all the bonus material, little video casts that we do and extra little nuggets that we find in conversations that don't make it into the main show, but we feel like you should hear. We don't put any of that behind a paywall. If you can't afford to support us, then just let me know and I'll set you up with an account. Of course, that'll be lifetime. And hopefully you'll be in a position someday to be able to support us. But you'll find all that on the website. All of you who have supported us or even joined our newsletter or bought Cloud-Based Mayhem merchandise, t-shirts or hats or anything, you should be all set up. You should have an account. And you should be able to access all that bonus material now. Thank you so much for listening. I really appreciate your support, and we'll see you on the next show. Thank you.